Today on Maine Calling, what it means to have celiac disease and to be gluten-free. It used to be uncommon to eliminate gluten from one's diet, but now the concept of gluten-free living has gone mainstream. Industry analysts estimate that Americans spent $8 billion on gluten-free products last year, and that number is expected to double by 2013. But only about 1% of people have celiac disease. Others have a wheat sensitivity. However, many people are going gluten-free simply because they believe it's healthier. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we discuss facts and misconceptions about eating gluten. And we learn some gluten-free dishes for Thanksgiving and beyond. What can you do if you're hosting a gluten-free guest? Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible by contributing listeners and support from Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure throughout Maine, now open in Bangor, Waterville, and Augusta. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering healthcare, education, and support to islands and coastal Downeast communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Gluten-free foods are now readily available at the grocery store, and many people buy them. What is behind this surge in attention to gluten? And what are the facts and misconceptions about celiac and gluten sensitivity? My guest today, Dr. Richard Sod, who is a gastroenterologist with Maine Health, and Caitlin G., a health coach and owner of G-Free Living, focused on eating gluten-free. We invite you to join the conversation. Are you one of the people who avoids eating gluten? If so, why? Send us a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org. Post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Thank you so much for joining us. Dr. Sod, I'll start with you. I have read that about 1% of people have celiac disease and really can't eat gluten. Do you believe that that number is accurate, or do you believe that celiac is underdiagnosed?
Well, based on the latest published literature in medical journals, studies have shown an incidence, or I should say a prevalence, of about one in approximately 133. So it is presently believed to be 1%. With that said, there probably is a fair amount of underdiagnosis. There are probably many individuals out there in the community who have celiac disease and have managed to simply live with the symptoms. I think the other thing that's important to understand is celiac disease can be a spectrum in terms of its severity, as well as a spectrum in terms of the immune response that's generated by those undigested gluten peptides. So given that spectrum that exists, I'm quite certain it's underdiagnosed, but our latest literature would indicate it's roughly 1% of our U.S. population.
Well, you mentioned people living with the symptoms. What are the symptoms?
The symptoms can be quite variable. Bowel issues are among the most common, so diarrhea, and in fact, constipation can also be a bowel symptom associated with celiac disease. And then there are a variety of other common GI symptoms that, you know, many folks experience in any given week, such as gas or excessive flatulence, bloating, nausea, abdominal pain. Those are probably among the most common of symptoms that are associated with adults. I'm not a pediatrician, but oftentimes children present in a different way. They oftentimes have issues with malabsorption or failure to grow on their growth charts, or just simply have a poor appetite. So there can be much more serious symptoms seen in the pediatric population.
Mm. You're talking about symptoms in the adult population versus pediatric, which makes me think, can someone develop it? Can someone not show symptoms as a child and then develop celiac as an adult?
Absolutely. The thing to understand about celiac disease is it's an interplay of having a genetic predisposition and then having an environmental exposure. And those two components come together at some point in an individual's life to bring about the condition of celiac disease.
And what is actually going on? What is celiac disease? Is it an allergy? Is it something else?
It's described as an immune-mediated response. So the situation with gluten is it's not completely digested by any of us. So there are these gluten peptides that remain. And what happens to an individual with celiac disease is there is an exaggerated immune response, which to those gluten peptides that are floating around, and that causes inflammatory response or the development of antibodies, and that leads to inflammation and eventual destruction of the lining of the small intestine, where we absorb so much of what we eat. And it's that destruction of the small bowel lining that leads to many of the symptoms and problems that folks have with untreated celiac disease.
You mentioned earlier some of the symptoms, and boy, are they varied, and they can be symptoms for so many other things. How do you test? How do you figure out that someone has it?
So there are two components to testing. There's what's called serologic or blood testing, and what we're testing for are the presence of some specific antibodies that exist with celiac disease. And in most instances, an individual that has an elevation in these celiac-related antibodies should have what's called an upper endoscopy, where a camera is inserted through the mouth into the small intestine, and biopsies are obtained from the lining of the small intestine. So it really does take a combination of both. As you can imagine, undergoing an endoscopy is quite invasive, there are now criteria in which an individual, both a pediatric or an adult individual, could be diagnosed simply based on the serologic testing. But there are very specific parameters that have to be met for that diagnosis to be made just on blood testing.
And an endoscopy, I'm guessing from the word scopy, means it's a scope. Describe that process.
Yeah, so this is an upper endoscopy. It's a flexible camera. It's about the size of your pinky finger. Most patients are sedated for this procedure, so they're asleep and they won't experience any discomfort or have any memory of the procedure in most instances. And this camera is inserted into the mouth once they're asleep. It's advanced down the esophagus or throat into the stomach, and then advanced beyond the stomach into the first part of our small intestine, which we refer to as the duodenum. And that is where we obtain biopsies with a very small biopsy device that's inserted through the scope itself. And the biopsies are a couple of millimeters in size.
All right. Caitlin, I want to bring you into the conversation. You help others now, but it's after a personal journey. Tell us about it. How did you figure out that you had celiac? Was it something that your parents figured out when you were a kid, or did you develop this as an adult?
I actually was an adult when I was diagnosed. So I was about 27 years old. So I've been living with it now just over a decade. I had, you know, a lot of the symptoms that Dr. Saad just talked about, bloating, you know, just very many different, from constipation to, you know, diarrhea. You know, I would feel very bloated most of the days. And so I finally, after going to a brewery tasting, I was in a lot of discomfort. And so it's like, all right, I really need to go figure out what's going on here.
And it wasn't like a bit of a journey. Did they figure it out right away, or did they think it was something else for a while?
I think for my case and my experience is I had a parent with an autoimmune disease. It was different. He had Addison's disease, but I think that played a part into my experience and being able to test for celiac disease. So I probably went through a 5 to 6 month journey figuring it out. And I did go through the process of having the endoscopy as well to get diagnosed.
When you started trying to eat gluten-free, was it challenging?
It was challenging, and it has really come a long way over the past decade. Again, in my experience, when I was diagnosed, I then had to go through what they call a gluten challenge, and I had to go back and eat it before my endoscopy. So that was a pretty painful process. But once I did go fully gluten-free, it was actually around this time of year, 11 years ago, and so I had my first gluten-free Thanksgiving, and it was challenging because, again, my family, was not familiar with what gluten-free meant. So this holiday is always kind of interesting for me because I think back to that first one I had to be gluten-free, and again, how far it's come.
Yeah, I'm guessing something like putting a little flour in the gravy, maybe was hard for people to get their head around, right? Not doing that, right?
Right,
Yeah.
exactly.
Yeah, well, so what do you do now? It's now your mission to help others. Tell us about your company, your business.
Yeah, so this again kind of sparked from living, with celiac and being gluten free. So back in 2019, I was traveling a bit for work, and this is kind of when social media, the whole, I guess you could call it, influencer content creators, were, all over Instagram. And so that's kind of how I figured out, like, when I was traveling, like, where to go and find, gluten-free items. And so I said, no one's really doing this here in Maine. So, Maine does have some great food here in Portland and throughout the whole state. So I created my Mrs. Ghee Free Living Instagram page. And so it's my last name and then gluten-free living, combined. And I also, at the time, had toddler twins, and they both had food allergies as well. So my page really focused on being gluten-free, allergy-friendly, family-type activities and foods. And then the pandemic hit, and I was really looking forward to when things opened because I really started to build this community online, but I really wanted to make it, in person, and to, like, be able to have people connect and gather over gluten-free food, because prior to my diagnosis, I was, I guess you could consider, a foodie, and so it was a big shift and change in my life. And so from there, in 2021, I had a restaurant owner take a chance on my idea, and so we hosted gluten-free nights a couple times a year, and would get people to come out and be able to have a full menu. That was gluten-free, and they had a dedicated fryer, and it kind of grew from there over the past 6 years.
And I apologize for mispronouncing your name. It's Kate Gee in Gee Free Living. I apologize for that. And I understand some of the things that people may not understand. You talked about a dedicated fryer. Folks who have a family with one or two people who have celiac have to have a separate toaster, right?
Yes. Actually, and my children's toaster just died this morning, so I need to get them a new toaster. And they asked why they couldn't use mine this morning, and again, I had to explain to them that the cross contact of food, we need to have things separate. So yes, the separate toasters. We also have a separate colander because, as we know, when you make spaghetti, it's hard to clean those. So those are just two of the things that we keep pretty separate here at my house.
So pretty, just a little bit can really set you off.
It can, yes.
Well, calling in now is Dr. Kevin Stamm with Maine Health. He's a pediatric gastroenterologist and pediatric nutrition provider. Thanks so much for calling in, Dr. Stamm. We did talk a little bit already about kids, but I want to go a little more in depth. Tell us how often you're finding celiac disease in childhood, and what age are the kids that you're diagnosing?
Well, thanks for having me, Jennifer. Kids are a little different. We know that probably about 20% of folks who get diagnosed with celiac disease are diagnosed before the age of 18, though you probably will know that some adult patients who are diagnosed in early adulthood may say their symptoms started earlier. Data suggests that the average age of kids is about 6 to 7 years old when they do get diagnosed, but we do see quite a lot of it.
And I'm wondering if it's possible to outgrow celiac.
The answer, in short, is no. It is seen as a lifelong disease requiring lifelong treatments, and the only treatment in kids at this stage is exclusion of gluten. And as Dr. Saad mentioned, there is a genetic predisposition followed by your gluten exposure, and that leads to that that inflammation. But no, it is considered at this stage a lifelong disease.
What symptoms should parents look out for? When ought a parent be concerned about their child?
They often mirror the same symptoms you may see in adults, although the classic symptoms like diarrhea are probably a little more common, especially in our youngest patients. And we can diagnose celiac disease even at a very young age, 0 to 3 years, we even see some patients with this. But it also includes abdominal pain, weight loss, or slow weight gain in kids. And, of course, we expect them to be gaining weight over time. And then other things that may be a little more vague or caused by other kinds of problems, things like anemia, vomiting, oral sores, problems with your tooth enamel, any of those could be related to celiac disease.
I imagine it's really challenging to be a kid and have celiac. I'm thinking about birthday parties and birthday cakes, Christmas cookies, pizza. How do you help parents? How do you help families?
Oh, that for sure is the biggest burden, and I'm glad you have some guests on here to talk more about how to handle that. But you just mentioned the big ones that we really face, things like birthday parties, sleepovers, a fast food restaurant that all your friends are going to, and notably the growing independence, of course, of adolescents as they start to question, hey, what can I do, what can't I do, and test those boundaries. Those are common things we have to deal with. So we try to make our explanations about celiac disease, the required diet, as appropriate developmentally for the stage, right? You'd say something different to an 8-year-old than you would to a 16-year-old. But you have to meet them where they're at. And I always tell folks at the first visit after diagnosis that this is really a process and we want you to be as healthy as possible, but we're going to handhold you as best we can to address the challenges that you'll inevitably face. And the ones you listed again are the big ones. It's challenging. We try to get folks, especially in pediatrics, you have to have a pediatric trained dietitian with you, and they will help. They will help guide, give you tricks of the trade, how to prepare for things like restaurants and sleepovers. But it does take preparation.
Well, Dr. Stamm, thanks so much for calling in. Dr. Stamm is a pediatric gastroenterologist with Maine Health. I do want to get into part of this conversation about all the other people who have decided to go gluten-free, but we do need to go to a break first. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Are you wondering whether or not to reduce gluten in your diet? Have you done so and found it helpful? We're learning about celiac disease and gluten-free diets. Joining me, Caitlin Gee, who is with Gee Free Living, where she serves as a health coach, and Dr. Richard Saad, a gastroenterologist with Maine Health. We invite you to join the conversation. What do you want to know about celiac or gluten intolerance? Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Dr. Saad, earlier in the program, you said that gluten is not completely digested by any of us. And I want to return to that. Is that the basis of the thinking for so many people who do not have celiac but still try to avoid gluten?
That's a part of the answer. The other thing that is important to understand is wheat. Let's just take wheat, for example. Wheat is not just a gluten, but wheat also contains what are called fructans. And fructans represent a class of what are referred to as FODMAPs. These are rapidly fermentable, small chain carbohydrates that can promote a variety of GI symptoms when they're eaten by many individuals. It's important to probably point out that there are probably far more individuals with gluten sensitivity than there are folks with diagnosed confirmed celiac disease. And it's probably a component of both of those elements. The fact that those peptides don't digest completely from the gluten, they can affect permeability of the gut mucosa. And then, of course, there are other, as I mentioned, other components that could also contribute to a variety of other GI symptoms.
Caitlin, I know a couple chefs and people who are foodies, as you say, who talk about the difference in flour and wheat in different parts of the world. Is that a part of the conversation that you have with your clients, or are you only talking to people who are trying to go completely gluten-free?
Yeah, the range of clients that I've had, either going gluten-free because they have celiac or, again, trying to eliminate some of that inflammation. I think one myth to kind of bust here, too, is some folks think that they can go to Italy and eat, you know, anything over there, but that's not true. It's like, you know, it's still wheat. It still has gluten in it. However, Italy does have a lot of celiac safe gluten-free options. You know, there are also some flours that are made with a gluten-free wheat starch, and that is removing the gluten from, like, and I'm probably not saying this scientifically correct, but there is gluten-free wheat starch products. So, like, for example, Caputo flour is a really great gluten-free flour that you can make pizza with. And so that was one of the things I really missed. However, if you do have a wheat allergy, someone wouldn't want to, you know, use that flour.
And Dr. Saad, I read this morning that 11% of young people, 11% of Gen Z avoid gluten. So is this a fad, or is there really good reason to do so? Or both?
I would imagine it's probably both. I think, you know, it's important to understand gluten is not inherently something you shouldn't eat. It is certainly something that is safe to ingest. It's just clear that for many individuals, and it just depends on the circumstances, they don't handle that food very well. Much as I had previously mentioned, this whole concept of low FODMAPs, there are a variety of other foods out there that probably prompt very similar symptoms when they're eaten to that of gluten. And again, it's not that these foods are bad. It's just that we all process foods in different ways. And for those individuals who don't tolerate gluten, they will be likely to avoid it. Another thing worth mentioning is the whole, in terms of the risk factors for celiac disease, one of the presumed potential risk factors is early exposure to gluten. So, you know, maybe Gen Z is a generation that has maybe been introduced to foods earlier on in their childhood than maybe other generations. And that might be why we're seeing a little bit more of a response to the ingestion of some of certain foods. It could have to do with that as well. It's unclear, but I think there are probably many contributors to this.
Caitlin, there are obvious things that people with celiac or people avoiding gluten want to avoid. We've mentioned cake and cookies and pizza and pasta. But I also know that there is gluten hiding in things that you might not expect. Give me a list of what some of the things you really help your clients look out for are.
Yeah, sure. So soy sauce being one of them, you know, it's used in a lot of marinades. If you go out for sushi, so you'll want to ask for tamari, and a lot of places do carry that now. You know, probably 10 years ago, I actually would bring my own with me because it, you know, just hadn't picked up yet with folks having it on hand. You know, again, with soups, you talked about gravy to thicken, you know, those sometimes flour is used. I'm trying to think what else I have learned over the years. I was eating Lindt chocolates, which actually contained barley malt. So you'll want to look at, you know, those holiday treats. And, you know, it's hard when items have barley malt or things like that, because it won't say, if you look at a label, it will say contains, you know, soy, contains dairy, but it doesn't say, you know, barley sometimes is one of those ones that can get missed. So it won't say contain wheat. So you just want to kind of double check those those labels.
So people want to avoid wheat and barley.
If you have celiac, yes.
Okay. We're going to go to Pam, who's calling from Carmel Highlands, California. Carmel Highlands. Hi, Pam. Go ahead. Pam, are you there?
Oh, hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, my name is Pam. I called because I was listening to one of your specialists who's described the many different symptoms that can be presented. And when our son, youngest son Gus, was diagnosed at the age of 6, I was telling one of your assistants, he'd been born in the 80th percentile for height and weight. By the time he was diagnosed, he wasn't on the growth chart at all, not even in the first percentile. So he was this tiny little feisty guy. His brothers are both very tall. And the reason we found out he had celiac disease is because he was developing symptoms of type 1 diabetes. We went to the pediatrician, rushed to the hospital, where we spent a week having him stabilized and with type 1 diabetes, so treated with insulin. And his endocrinologist had the opportunity to meet his brothers, who visited us there at Maine Medical, and said, well, there's something else going on here, because these two people are very tall and this guy is small. My husband and I are both tall. So ran a battery of tests, and Gus came back positive for celiac disease. And I, in my advocacy work and fundraising work for JDRF and then around celiac disease, I have heard it described as the great pretender, because it can look like so many different things. And I've met kids and adults who, one little boy who was being treated for symptoms of cancer for 3 years, and he was diagnosed at about the age of 3, and we met him. He was the same age as Gus, 6. And some doctor suggested, let's run some blood tests. And he came back testing positive for celiac disease and went on a gluten-free diet, and his other symptoms disappeared.
Wow. Pam, can I ask you, how long ago was your son diagnosed?
He was diagnosed in 1998.
So a whole different world back then.
Whole different world. There was very, very little. But there were things coming from Canada and a decent enough bakery in Florida. But I love to cook and eventually left my business in the art field and started a gluten-free baking company and just made Gus and his normal as possible life my priority. So heard people talking about how do you prepare for a birthday party, but I would call the family and say, what are you serving? And I'd make it gluten-free and deliver it before the party started.
Pam, is Gus thriving today?
Gus is thriving today. He's amazing. He went to the island school in the Bahamas during his junior year. It's a semester program where kids, the thesis is, if you can save an island, you can save the world. So kids do research projects, they scuba dive, they go on solos, it's a remarkable experiential education program. He was told probably you don't want to do the diving, but we figured out a protocol for him to test before he went down under, and then a way to deliver glucose if he felt like he needed it underwater. And he's now, he's gone anywhere and everywhere, including above and beyond. I'm really proud of him.
That's right. I'm so happy you called in. And Dr. Saad, are you surprised by Pam's story, or does this reflect your experience in this field?
No, well, first of all, Pam, thank you for sharing this story. But I think, as was pointed out, this is 2025. And I have to say, I would say in the healthcare community, the awareness of celiac disease and the easy ability we have to order screening testing for it has changed tremendously over the last nearly 30 years. And I'm seeing that in my practice, patients that I see all the time from primary care, have had the testing done as a part of workup for this, again, very wide variety of symptoms. You know, we've also learned that there are a number of other conditions that should prompt the testing for celiac disease. It's been mentioned things like iron deficiency anemia or osteoporosis or infertility or a skin condition that kind of looks like the ongoing case of chickenpox called dermatitis herpetiformis. I have dermatologists that refer patients to me saying, I think you need to work this patient up for celiac disease. So we've come a long way in terms of our awareness. And we actually have a specified panel when we order for celiac disease at our center, where you not only get the antibody, but you also check for a particular immune globulin called IgA, because there's a deficiency associated frequently with celiac disease in that immune globulin, and that can throw off your antibody testing. That's what I would have to say about where we are today.
Pam, thanks for your call. Let's see, we'll go to Stephanie calling from St. George, New Brunswick. We have a large geographic area today. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Yes, go ahead.
Awesome, I'm in my car. I'm just driving on the highway. I'll be honest, I'm almost 60, and this is the first time I've ever called into a radio, so this was an important one.
Well, thank you.
So just quickly, it is very important to distinguish between celiac and gluten insensitivity. When you're celiac, especially, I had a boyfriend back in the 90s, and he was 30 and diagnosed, but he'd been celiac from a child. And the pain of getting even so much as a half a dozen crumbs into his abdomen and his intestine was horrific. So he never trusted anybody back then because you couldn't buy gluten-free food. So he pretty much ate bacon and eggs and meat and eggs and bacon, you know, every day of his life. And we went on vacation to Jamaica for 2 weeks. And the first day we were there, they, of course, had a lovely breakfast buffet. And, of course, we thought, well, you can't go wrong with that. But the scrambled eggs must have been powdered because he spent the first 3 or 4 days of our vacation curled around the toilet with his belly extended until he could pass the gluten out of his system. So I used to tell him when we would go to restaurants, because people didn't understand, don't tell them that you're celiac. Tell them you're allergic to gluten. And if they get any bread on your meal, you'll go into anaphylactic shock. And that's enough to get their brains working. Now it's different. And you can buy just about anything, at least up here. We have entire sections of gluten-free everything. It is more expensive, but we're also lucky enough that if you file your income tax, you can claim a certain amount of money per year for the extra cost because gluten-free food, of course, costs more money.
So oh, that's interesting.
The second thing I wanted to say is about 20 years ago, I was in the eye doctor's office. And I read a very little obscure article in some weird magazine here in Canada about gluten and the possible effects that it has on someone who has restless leg syndrome. And it had something to do with something at the base of the brain, blah, blah, blah. My father at the time was in his 70s and had horrific restless leg syndrome for years. And he was actually on like Parkinson's medication to control it. And he was on the last medication, and it was sort of starting to not work anymore. So I read this article. I cut it out. I gave it to my mom. She said it's worth a try. They went completely 100% gluten-free. And within 6 months, he was off all the medication, and he never went back on it again. And
oh,
his
so,
restless
yeah.
legs all but...
I'm so glad that worked. Dr. Sott, I'll ask you about that. Does that surprise you?
Not at all. I'm actually glad that this caller called in with this story because there are a large variety of neurologic conditions that have been associated with celiac disease. This can include extremity numbness and tingling, ataxia, which is a problem with gait and balance, depression, headaches, epilepsy, just to name many of them, anxiety. So there's a large variety of neurologic conditions that should prompt a provider and a patient to consider the possibility that celiac disease is at hand here.
Wow. So I'm listening to you, Dr. Saad, and listening to Stephanie, and you're talking about all these symptoms. And, you know, it's no surprise to me that a lot of people just try to cut gluten out of their diet just in case. I mean, is that something that you think is a reasonable decision?
Well, as Caitlin mentioned, the challenge is if an individual comes to me and wants to know if they have celiac disease or not, and they're on a gluten-free diet, it gets a little harder to make the diagnosis, because not only can the antibodies go away, but also the changes in the GI tract can resolve. So even an endoscopy may not be helpful. It does so happen that we have the ability, we have two options. You can either ask that patient to go back onto a gluten-containing diet, and that can be very hard for patients. We ask for a minimum of 2 weeks and ideally a period of 6 weeks. But if that isn't a possibility, we do have genetic testing we can offer because there are specific alleles that can be found in the genetic footprint called DQ2 and DQ8. So that's the specific test we order. If an individual does not have either of those alleles on a genetic test, then they do not have celiac disease and you're dealing with celiac sensitivity. If they do have those alleles, one of those two, that doesn't mean they have the diagnosis, but it would be a more important reason to pursue that testing further in some way to determine if there is actually celiac disease. Because another point that I think was made at some point in this show is somebody with celiac disease has to remain off gluten for their life. Somebody with celiac sensitivity doesn't have to necessarily remain off of gluten. They just will be prepared to experience some GI unpleasantness if they do ingest food with gluten. So it's a little bit of difference in the importance of maintaining a gluten-free diet, depending on your condition, because there are serious problems that can happen with untreated celiac disease, including forms of cancer.
Wow. Stephanie, thanks so much for your call. We are going to take another quick break. If you have questions for our guests, we're talking about celiac disease. We're talking about gluten-free diets. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We're talking about gluten-free diets. We're talking about celiac disease today on Maine Calling. Our guests, Dr. Richard Saad with Maine Health and Caitlin Gee with Gee Free Living. Share your comments and questions. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. You can post on Facebook or Instagram, or you can call 1-800-399-3566. Before we get back to the calls, Caitlin, I want to ask you an important question this week. Many of us are hosting others for Thanksgiving. I'm guessing a big tip would be if you make gravy, maybe leave out the flour and use cornstarch instead. Will that work?
Yeah, that's a great one. A lot of stores now, like Trader Joe's and Whole Foods, they actually carry some gluten-free option buy off-the-shelf gravies, which is great. That's where I like to get mine just because it's easy. There's quite a few main bakeries that are dedicated gluten-free. There's one in Saco called Sweets & Co. A lot of these bakeries do some pre-orders, so that's a great option. I love Maine Pie Co., and that is a frozen pie that you can easily find at Hannaford and some of the specialty food markets as well.
All right. Thanks for the tips. We'll go to Susan calling from Raymond. Hi, Susan. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'd like to know more about the correlation between diabetes and celiac and or gluten sensitivity. I know the caller prior had mentioned that, and I was a school nurse for years. And as time went on, they were testing our kids, new diabetics, and they did a blood test to see if they had a gluten sensitivity and also lactose intolerance. Some of these kids have also both. Thank you,
Dr. Saad.
Yes. With regard to the question about the diabetes, so it's important to understand we are talking specifically about what is called type 1 diabetes or insulin-dependent diabetes. This is an immune-mediated condition. So it's caused by autoantibodies that injure the pancreas and cause the diabetes. Much like that condition, celiac is once again mediated by the immune system. So these are immune-mediated diseases, and that's the connection between type 1 diabetes and celiac disease. And it's important to understand that association is so strong that anybody with type 1 diabetes should have screening done for celiac disease. That is not the same for the insulin-resistant or type 2 diabetes that we probably see a lot more of, particularly in adults. These are folks that are taking a variety of medications, like the GLP-1s now, for management of their diabetes. Not the same association as with type 1 diabetes. The question about the lactose. Lactose has to do with an absence of the enzymes that are present on the lining of the small bowel to break down that particular sugar. The association is probably related to the damage that's done to the lining of the small bowel that impairs its absorption. So that might be the connection between lactose intolerance and possibly celiac disease, but there's not a specific association with those two conditions. There are other autoimmune diseases too, by the way. So,
oh, really? Go ahead.
Somebody with autoimmune thyroid disease, they should be screened for celiac disease. Patients that have Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis or microscopic colitis, so those are inflammatory bowel conditions, they also should have screening for celiac disease. And one other condition that is very strongly associated with celiac disease is Down syndrome. So anybody with Down syndrome, now these folks can't tell you about their symptoms, but they should be tested, mandatory, should be tested for celiac disease because of the strong correlation between the two conditions.
And earlier you were talking about genetic testing that's available. Is the reason that that's not the first thing that's done, is the reason cost, or is the reason because it is just part of the diagnosis?
Well, remember what I said is for celiac disease to occur, you have to have a genetic predisposition and an environmental exposure. What we know about this genetic predisposition is that probably is present in nearly 20% of the population, but we're not seeing that many folks with celiac disease. So so having those haplotypes that, you know, basically put you at a predisposition for celiac disease doesn't mean you're going to actually develop celiac disease at some point in your life. So it's not a diagnosis that you can make by that testing.
All right, Susan, thanks for your call. Caitlin, when somebody has been diagnosed either with celiac or a gluten insensitivity and begins to eat a wheat-free and barley-free diet, how quickly do you see their lives improve for the people that you work with?
I really think it's all dependent on the person. I mean, even for myself, it took me, 6 months to a year to start to feel better. Like Dr. Assad was just talking about, I had to go on a low FODMAP diet. I worked very closely with a dietitian, nutritionist. So again, I had to go dairy free for a while. So it took a while for that healing to occur. So I think it's really just depends on the person.
Not overnight, though, it sounds like.
If I could add a quick point. When we're monitoring an individual with celiac disease, we will usually use the antibody testing to demonstrate that they're doing a good job with their maintenance. But we refrain from doing repeat endoscopy with biopsies for 2 years. So it can take several years for the injury to that small bowel to recover, even though the antibodies could be gone in 3 to 6 months. So as Caitlin pointed out, it can be a long process and it can take a while to regain the normal absorptive capacity and the normal permeability of the small bowel after you've taken away that injury.
Yeah, and so just to add to that, and I, again, sharing my medical experience with celiac is I just had my second endoscopy about 2 years ago. So that was like about, like a 6 to 7 year gap there. And then again, I was also, I ended up having a colonoscopy to also see if I had some of those other autoimmune diseases that he was explaining about earlier. And hey, thankfully, and they came back negative.
I asked you about Thanksgiving, but so many of us might have somebody, a house guest or somebody coming over for dinner who needs to avoid gluten. I'm wondering if you have some other guidance. One thing I can think of is it okay to maybe make a dish with rice or make a dish with potatoes instead of a pasta? And if so, I mean, what about your colander, your pots and pans? What is your advice if you are hosting someone who is either has celiac or a serious insensitivity?
Yeah, I think a couple tips. I think the planning ahead is always key. So whether you're going to be a guest or you're the host, that communication is key, figuring out what's going to work for the person, what they're comfortable with. Because some, when I first initially was diagnosed, like I had that hard time trusting people that they understood what my needs were with celiac. So I would bring my own dishes, but anything with rice, quinoa, potato is great, to have those dishes. Again, with the cross contact, it's like if you're cutting a loaf of bread, you wouldn't then want to go cut the gluten-free loaf of bread. So my tip is always do gluten-free first and like always let the person that's gluten-free serve themselves first, because as we know, sometimes spoons can be shared with the stuffing and then the potato. So it's also keeping things separate from, one end of the bar to the other is always helpful. And honestly, it's like if you just go 100% gluten-free, which is great if the hosts do that, that makes it a little bit easier. But it can be a world of having both. I think it's just being planful and mindful of where things are.
All right. So it's not like a peanut allergy where it's okay if you're in the same room with bread or pasta or something like that.
Yeah, I don't think I'd want to go work in a bakery that is full of gluten-filled flour, but they're not going to have the anaphylactic like if it was a tree nut or peanut allergy. But, all right. Back to that caller where she was saying, when I do dine out, I do say that it is an allergy because then it is taken a bit more seriously. So that is something I recommend to some of my clients as well.
We'll go to David calling from Bar Harbor. David, if you could be quick, that would be great.
Hello, thanks. I just was curious, do all people with celiac or a gluten sensitivity have GI signs, or the people with the signs outside the GI, like thyroid problems or other diseases that he mentioned, will they potentially lack GI signs?
Dr. Saad.
Yes. Thank you for the question. And as I previously mentioned in this show, there is a spectrum of presentation, and there's a component of patients who will have none of the GI symptoms, and instead they may manifest one of the complications of celiac disease, such as having an iron deficiency, or having that skin rash that I mentioned, or an issue with fertility, for instance. So there are folks that will not have any GI symptoms, but you sometimes have to think about the other ways that they may manifest their condition. There are a variety of vitamin deficiencies that can develop if it's untreated long enough. Absolutely don't have to have the symptoms of, and again, I had mentioned something we didn't talk about. So if you have a family member diagnosed with celiac disease, all first degree relatives of that patient should also be tested. Many of them may not have symptoms, but they may have celiac disease. So absolutely, don't have to have the symptoms.
Okay, David, thanks for your call. Karen, we have just a few seconds left. Karen in Waterville, can you ask your question in a few seconds?
Very quickly, does fasting, intermittent fasting or a 24-hour fast have any effect on these conditions?
Dr. Saad.
What matters is how important it is that you avoid gluten and whether you're eating the gluten when you are not fasting. So no, fasting won't It will not eliminate your condition or necessarily eliminate your sensitivity. If you're going to eat it at a non-fasting period of time, you're probably going to you're going to get symptoms if you have a gluten sensitivity, possibly, but your celiac disease will remain untreated.
All right. Well, thank you, Karen, for your call. And thank you to our guest, Dr. Richard Sod, a gastroenterologist with Maine Health, and and Caitlin Gee, a health coach who started Gee Free Living, and that's G-E-E. Today's sound engineer, Sam Tracy. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, we listen back to our earlier conversation with organic farming pioneer Elliot Coleman. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you have been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.